Our next guest, do we have our next guest on the line yet, Len? Yeah, we are. Just a minute. We're just calling him up. It'll be David Berner, and many of you might know him more for his work that he's done on the radio here in the West Coast. The talk show host himself, good interviewer, lovely dulcet tones, beautiful radio voice.
Yes.
We have him on the show tonight because he is very much interested in drug policy here in British Columbia, mm-hmm. and specifically about the ongoing tragedies that are going on in the infamous, the notorious downtown east side mm-hmm. of Vancouver. Joining us now, David Berner. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you?
That's great, thank you. I'm Terry O'Neill here, and of course Mark Hashik is over there on the other microphone.
Lovely.
Good, David. Good to hear from you.
Yes. How are you, sir?
Very good.
Okay.
When last we talked on this show about the downtown east side and the drug problems, it was just in the wake of a conference that I believe that you were a part of, David, and Mark was at as well.
I was actually called the conference together, and I was the chairman.
Yes. Can you remind our viewers and listeners here about what that conference was actually looking at?
The conference was the first regional gathering of prevention and treatment providers. So I had called together as many as I could of people who run programs for drug prevention, mostly with youngsters, and also people who provide recovery programs. Most of those were abstinence-based residential programs, and we had about 50 some people say they were attending, and in reality about 37 or something showed up, and it was fabulous. It was a wonderful experience.
Now, David, you're the executive director of the Drug Prevention Network of Canada. Please tell our listeners and our viewers about that organization.
The organization began about 6 years ago, thanks to former parliamentarian Randy White, who I think originally was elected perhaps in Alberta and then Abbotsford. Randy was a reform member, came along with Preston Manning, and then was a conservative member. He's now retired and lives on Vancouver Island. And the organization was begun with him and a woman in Toronto who's a lawyer, and their goal was to do exactly what the organization states in its title, to do whatever it can to further drug prevention. But because they really were just a handful of like-minded people, they didn't really go into much action. And about 6 months ago, they said, you know, we should get ourselves a part-time executive director and really try to do something.
Right.
So that's what happened. I mean, I came aboard. I work, it's a sort of part-time job. And I came aboard with some credentials because I'm sort of a pioneer in Canada. And the
now you founded the Ex-Calais Foundation 40 years ago, right?
Yeah, 45
that's a
years.
Residential treatment center, and it's still operating in Winnipeg. Am I right about that?
Yes, exactly. It's on September 16th. I will fly to Winnipeg and attend the 40th anniversary of what in the past would be called Ex-Calais Manitoba Inc., but it's gone through a couple of name changes, and the current title is Behavioral Health Foundation, and people can look it up. Those who are following this in front of the computers can look it up at www.bhf.ca.
Now, you're a champion for addictions recovery, and you're a vocal opponent, as I am, as Terry is. So you're in good company tonight. A vocal opponent of the harm reduction policies that have really gripped British Columbia.
Yes.
From the
and the world.
And the world, sure. For locally here, we have the InSight supervised injection site. We have a wild, unregulated methadone program. And we have many wrong-headed, what I would consider, not going to put words in your mouth, wrong-headed recovery homes. In your time in BC, maybe you could just give me and our listeners a sense of how we got to this point. Because a lot of people come to Vancouver and they see some of the stuff going on and they're shaking their heads and they're thinking, what happened?
You know, it's so ironic. I was just having a bite to eat an hour or so earlier, and I was flipping through channels, and on KCTS 9, the public channel from Seattle, Rick Steve, the famous travel videographer, was visiting Switzerland. And so he then did something I've never seen him do before, which I found shocking. But he, in that jolly, friendly, avuncular way of his, started telling us all about the wonderful thing the Swiss have, this wonderful practical attitude about reducing harm. And he showed addicts going, and they put a coin in a machine and they get clean needles. And then they have a place where they can dump their needles into a receptacle that no one will stab themselves. And then they go to a little window and some misbegotten fool hands them their latest supply of dope or needles or whatever it is they get. And I found it astonishing. But anyway, let me go back to, sure, to how did we get here.
Yeah.
I first moved here, you know, almost 50 years ago from Manitoba, and you know, this is a port city, and it was known as a wonderful, exciting, and interesting, a new kind of place. It had a lot of jazz clubs, a lot of music, a lot of rhythm and blues, but it also had a heroin problem, because it's a port. And but the heroin problem was contained. It was geographically limited to Maine and Hastings, basically. And the numbers were relatively small. And the only way anybody dealt with that issue in 40 and 50 years ago was the Narcotics Police Division of the Vancouver City Police. There was a legendary narco cop, I won't say his name, but he had a funny Eastern European name, and people used to describe him as high on the chase of addicts as the addicts were on heroin. He took special delight in chasing people down. And in those days,
Kojak?
Yeah, Kojak, it's close, you got it.
Okay.
The reason I know this is that one of my friends was a brilliant visionary jazz piano player and painter, who's kind of a legendary character in Vancouver, and I used to hang out with artists of one kind or another when I was a young man, and he told me about being chased by this guy and having this guy break through his little shack door in Deep Cove and so on. But these were different times. It was a simpler, more romantic kind of city, and an easy city to live in if you didn't have a lot of money.
Sure.
Anyway, so what happened was that an addict at one point had very few choices. You could survive somehow, you could get killed in a bad buy, you could get choked to death by this cop, this famous cop who choked people to death apparently, or you could be sent to prison and either get even more heroin in prison or kick your habit out of necessity because there wasn't a good supply. There were very limited choices. A few years after I started doing my work, I started giving a public lecture all the time called the Shopper's Drug Mart of Therapy, because all of a sudden, where there had been nothing, within about 10, 15 years, everybody and their uncle was providing some sort of brilliant answer, most of which, of course, didn't work. And I will tell you literally how the harm reduction thing happened. I remember vividly that Mayor Philip Owen, at the time I was a broadcaster at CKNW Radio for many, many years.
Yep.
And Philip, I gave him my show once, just for fun, when we made it the Philip Owen Show. And he knew my history in running an addiction center, which I'll talk about later. And he called me one day and he said, David, come meet me at the hotel across the street from City Hall. I want to pick your brain about addictions. So I said, great. And we sat there for 3 hours, and he had yellow foolscap notepaper, and he took pages and pages of notes. And everything I said about addictions, he went, oh, yeah, that's right. I have a cousin just like that. Oh, yeah, what an insight. That's great. Yeah, that's terrific. And he took all these notes. And then to my horror and astonishment, about a week later, announced what he called the four-pillar system, which was supposed to be harm reduction, enforcement, policing, and treatment. And within a matter of days, it became self-apparent that what we really had was one pillar and three matchsticks, because nobody paid any attention to prevention, treatment, or policing enforcement. Nobody, as in governments. And all of the energy suddenly went into this idea that what we have to do is reduce the harm created by addicts. The best example that I can give you is one of the editorial writers for The Sun, who at one point wrote an editorial praising the harm reduction approach. I called her, phoned her, and said, you know, I'd like to have a coffee with you and share with you a slightly different perspective, and she refused to do it. Then, 10 years later, after her apartment and her car had been broken into 29 times, guess what? She changed her tune.
Yeah.
She finally realized that this is not working, and so she changed her tune. Can I just tell you about an incident that just happened last week?
Yeah, go ahead, and yeah. I've got some questions.
Okay,
go ahead.
Last week I had the great pleasure and honor of going up to Prince George and spending 3 days doing some work and consulting with Baldy Hughes Rehabilitation and Addiction Recovery Center. It's on an old Army base site about 35 minutes outside of Prince George. And they've got about 50 guys, and they're gearing up to add to it to about 30 when they finish the next building. Well, the second day I was there, gentlemen, they had a convocation and grad ceremony, and the joint was packed. I mean, there were parents and siblings and children and sweethearts and spouses and so on attending this ceremony. And the first part of the ceremony, which was beautiful, was four different guys got their matriculation. This may sound like a small, nothing thing, but it's enormous. One of the guys was middle-aged, for God's sake. So here's guys going through life with no armament that most of us take for granted. The three of us all have, I didn't finish my university, but we all basically have university degrees, and we've all matriculated like crazy, and we take for granted our ability to read and write. Mm-hmm. Here's guys, you know, flaying around in life without the basic abilities, and a teacher, out of the goodness of his heart, and thank God to the superintendent of schools up in that district and so on, they also attended. This guy, Peter, he drives out twice a week, and he teaches people math and English. And here's four guys getting their grade 12 diplomas. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I mean, it's very emotional.
It's
very
beautiful
to watch. And then four guys graduated from the recovery program. And again, I mean, it was just so emotionally powerful. When I gave a speech on Tuesday, the next day, I gave an hour-long speech. And in the middle of it, I said, folks, you have to put into perspective the work that you're doing here in an abstinence-based recovery program. There are no graduation ceremonies at Insight. There are no grad ceremonies at the Needle Exchange. There are no grad ceremonies at the crack pipe, clean crack pipe window or whatever. None of these harm reduction programs have graduation ceremonies because there's nothing to graduate from or to.
Because
all of these programs are keeping people stupid.
That leads exactly to the question that I had, is that the measurement of how we know or don't know that something is working or not working. The harm reduction advocates continually say that the harm reduction policy, the Insight especially, is saving lives. And that they say that the number of fatalities have fallen down and have fallen, those sorts of things. Is that a fair way of measuring? Is that measurement actually correct? Is that those statistics correct? And B, is the number of lives being saved
To answer your second part first, it might be a fair way of measuring it. The only problem is that the same people turn out the same alleged results over and over and over again, and their studies are flawed and sophomoric. There are real scientists all over the world who constantly refute these thin reports and constantly say, this is not good science, these are not good reports, there are just as many fatalities as we've always had, and you cannot claim that you're saving lives. It's bullshit. Okay? Now, there is another way you could measure success.
Yes.
The way that the Behavioral Health Foundation and umpteen other recovery programs here in across Canada and who attended our conference measure it, it's called clean living days. If one person stays clean and sober, let's say you have a program of 50 people. If one person stays clean and sober today, that's one clean living day. If all 50 of them stay clean and sober, that's 50 clean living days. I can tell you with great pride, because I started this program 45 years ago, that BHF in Manitoba is in the millions of clean living days, and I have watched people graduate, move to transition houses, and move back into the community successfully. In fact, may I tell you another quick story that's relevant?
Hold on to that just for a second, because I think you really hit on something here with the clean living days. The harm reduction people, insight people, would say, no, what's really important is living days. It doesn't matter if you're addicted or not. Well, if you're addicted, it doesn't really matter as long as you're alive. And there is something fundamentally wrong with that attitude.
There's something fundamentally offensive about that attitude. I don't know where you grew up, but I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home, and I'm not a practicing Jew, but I'm a Jew by character and by nature. And I find this morally, spiritually, not religiously, but spiritually offensive. One of the women at the conference, I know Mark probably heard her, a wonderful gal who is a very active participant in a recovery program. She's on staff. She's gone through recovery herself. She said, look, this is about human dignity and human suffering. Mm. Being an addict and being alive is an ugly place to be. Being a using addict means you're enslaved to pharmaceuticals, to drugs, and you're wonked out most of your life, and you can't do much of anything. You can't really have sex. You can't really cook a good pot roast. You're not really interested in food. You're not interested in your children. You're not interested in much of anything except your next fix. It's a zombie kind of existence. And why would anyone trumpet that or claim it as a triumph? It's pathetic.
It really is. And David, I know that you have seen the look on people's faces many, many, many times. Now, I know exactly the woman you're talking about at the conference. I won't mention her name.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But to see someone who has, I wouldn't say conquered, because as you know, it's a long struggle, but to see someone who has risen from the ashes,
yes,
and to see that look in their eyes, it's an absolutely beautiful thing. There's a great book by Dr. Gerald May called Addiction and Grace. I would recommend it to anybody that touches on the spiritual aspect of recovering from addictions.
Yes.
I want to get back to, because you alluded to it, get back to the media for a second.
Sure.
And Insight, although I want to caution people, Insight is not the be-all and end-all when it comes to harm reduction in Vancouver. There are other larger policies actually that affect more people. But Insight, in my opinion, does the best job of playing the media. They are as much a PR organization as they are whatever they want to call themselves, organization. There was a good example of it a couple of months ago when one of these studies came out, offered by the same people, we know who they are, and they wanted to celebrate this in the media. I forget exactly what this one study was claiming to, what success it claimed, but they invited all the media down. They had one addict, recovering addict, down there who they kind of trotted out, and he gave this a very lovely story about how Insight helped him, recapture his life, and that that story, that man's story, was played on all the major newspapers in Vancouver. When I or somebody else, I know you as a longtime journalist have felt this, if you go against now the harm reduction gospel, you are somehow anti-poor people, anti-addict, perhaps ultra-conservative.
Well, look, let's give real examples. Tom Sanborn is a wonderful writer. He's a local guy, and he's a bit of a shit disturber, and he's a bit of a rebel, and he's a supporter of people who struggle, and he's a guy I admire. But having said that, and I like him, he's kind of a buddy, you know, and we're fellow journalists. But one day, about a month ago, I think you, Mark, had written one piece on the right-hand side of the page, and on the left-hand side, we're talking about the Courier,
yep.
And on the left-hand side, Tom wrote a guest editorial in which he accused Harper of killing people if he shuts down Insight.
Right.
And I just thought, oh, Tom, you've bought this whole mythology, hook, line, and sinker, and you just don't get it.
No, I think that's exactly right.
And you're right. I mean, the media has just, it's the emperor's new clothes. Everybody just dances to the same tango. The only problem is it's the poison tango.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't make any sense. But let me very quickly, so before I forget it, get this off my chest, just to give you the other side of the coin. As recently as 3 weeks ago, I was walking away from Granville Island one day, having picked up some groceries, and a woman walked past me, and we sort of nodded at each other as if we vaguely knew each other. I got about another 3 feet, and then she called my name, and I turned around, and she said, "Aren't you David?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "Didn't you run the drug treatment program all those years ago?" I said, "Yes." "Oh, one of your people," she says, "I ran group homes for kids, and one of your graduates was our best group home leader." Well, that guy came into our program in 1970. He came out of Prince George Jail. He was an Aboriginal from Kenora, Ontario. He was a career thief and bootlegger and God knows what else, and drinker, of course. And he came into our program and worked his ass off. He blew it badly after 3 months. We really, you know, put him back into sweeping floors and cleaning the bathrooms, and he crawled his way back in terms of responsibilities. And I played many football games with and against him. I played bridge with him. I was in 100 groups with him and so on. And he was a handful, but he was a terrific guy. And he got married in our program, and he and his wife went and ran group homes and did fantastic human work.
Mm. Oh, that's good.
You know?
Well, speaking of these group homes, we have, and I want to remind our listeners that they're free to send in email questions, queries, concerns to roadkillradio@live.ca. And we do have an email from Wayne who wants to know about how many abstinence-based recovery homes are there in the Lower Mainland, and are they opposed by government policy? Do they get funding from the government if they don't embrace harm reduction, or how do they?
Those are good questions. Let me try to answer. I can't give Wayne. I can't give the exact number, but I would say there's somewhere between a dozen and 20. Some are private. No, there's probably more. There's programs on Bowen Island, programs on Vancouver Island. There's programs up in the valley, and I'd say there's somewhere between a dozen and let's say maybe as many as 30. The question about funding is a crucial and important question. Most of these programs receive government funding in one way or another, usually not block funding. Most of them don't get a pile of money just to operate. Mostly they get paid per bed, per client, so they have to keep their client numbers up. But there is an unfortunate phenomenon going on with government funding right now. There's a very awful, complex one with another agency, which I may try to describe, but let me give you the simple one. Many of these programs are abstinence-based, and what has happened is that the government is saying to these abstinence-based programs, you will take people on methadone or we won't fund you. Now, when I was doing evening talk radio at NW, an agency who's still around, has been around for 30-plus years, came to me with this problem and showed me a letter from a bureaucrat in Victoria saying, you're going to take a methadone people or we'll cut off your funding. And I phoned Penny Pretty, who at the time was the minister, and got her right-hand person. And I said, look, this is David from CKNW. You have a stick of dynamite at your door, and you better address this or you're going to have a big public foo-foo-rah in your face. 2 days later, this agency got a letter from the same bureaucrat saying, oh my goodness, I misspoke myself, forget the first letter. So they withdrew, but it keeps coming back, and these people are constantly under pressure to accept harm reduction methodologies in their program. And let me tell you ironies about this.
Yeah, before you get to the ironies, David, I just want to share with you to reinforce that. There's been a big debate in Coquitlam, where I live, and sort of involved in public affairs there, about the nature of the new emergency shelter that they want to build for the homeless. It's not an emergency anymore. They want to make it a permanent homeless shelter to transition the people off the living by the riverbanks and try to get them into the community. Well and fine, except apparently this has to be a low barrier one. The provincial government is saying low barrier. What does that mean? That means that that you're not allowed to tell people you can't use drugs in there. You're not allowed to tell people that they can't, even if we catch you selling drugs on the sidewalk, you're out of here. No, they're not allowed to interfere in what these guys do in their rooms, outside the building, on the neighborhood streets nearby, or anything like that. Low barrier. And I thought, holy mackerel, no wonder the residents in the neighborhood
are so
upset.
But that's part of the age of entitlement. Yeah. That we live in it. We have to look at this, you know, in a larger context. What you've described is horrifying and inappropriate, no question. But it's part of the way we do everything today. Nobody can ever tell anybody anything, because everybody's entitled to do their own thing, regardless of its consequences to the world around them. Nobody pays any attention to the world around them, as we know. Today, I was driving south on Burrard Street, and I had to stop at Helmiken at the light. There was an SUV next to me parked in the ambulance zone.
Yeah.
There are yellow, bright orange stripes all over the street, which mean don't stop your car here,
yeah,
because this is the entrance to the emergency.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there in his SUV talking on his cell phone.
Yes.
So here's a guy breaking the law twice, and he doesn't care. So that's look, you know, 40 years ago, I was running this abstinence-based program, and I heard about a thing called Alma House. And I was curious to see what kind of work they did. So I went up, and here was this nice lady, and she was sort of an, I would describe her, characterize her perhaps unfairly, but an aging hippie, you know. She was sort of one of your Cortez Island people, you know.
Yes,
she had
yes.
frizzy gray hair, and
yes.
she wore long dresses, and
right, right.
was soft-spoken.
There was a whole bunch of them down in the, there was a whole bunch of those people down at Colony Farm. There was a fair day.
Well, we have one of them as mayor now. Anyway, so she explained to me that they had no curfews. They were working with teenage kids who were on drugs, and they believed that you had to let kids work their stuff out on their own schedule, you know.
Whoa.
Of course, I was running a program that was, you know, the exact opposite. It was a very Protestant work ethic, very hard-nosed, get up in the morning, so on. Anyway, so I just listened to her, and I didn't think anything of it except that I thought she was crazy and wasting her time. And I thanked her. We spent about an hour together, and then I was leaving. And a kid of about 16 years old came in, and I started to walk out, and he started talking to me, except he was swearing at me. He was F you this and F you that and so on. And I just looked at him, and I smiled, and I said, I'm sorry, son, but you've made a miscalculation. You think that I work here, and therefore you can, you know, swear at me. I'm a visitor, and so I'm not interested in your acting out bullshit, okay? So that raised the level, and he started yelling at me and swearing at me. So I grabbed him by the collar and lifted him off his feet and smashed him against the wall. And I said, I don't think you understood what I said. I don't work here. I'm a guest. And if you don't shut your mouth, you'll be in the hospital for the next week. That's not how I worked with people, but that's the difference. Of course they're saying, what did they call it? Low threshold? Low.
Whatever.
Of course, if you're going to operate
low barrier,
shelter, you can't let people sell drugs. You have to make it a safe place. You know, 2 years ago, I visited BHF in Manitoba, and the first person I met after the woman who runs it, her name is Jean, after she was showing me around, the first kid I met was 18 years old, an Aboriginal kid, and he smiled at me as we were walking across the property, and so I smiled back, and I said, "Hi, my name's David." And he took my hand. He said, "I'm James." And I said, "Hi, James. How long have you been here?" He said, "2 months." And I said, "What do you think?" He said, "Oh, I love it." I said, "Really? Why?" And he said, "I feel safe here." I feel safe here, you know? Isn't that wonderful?
That sort of reinforces the old story that I tell sometimes. It's sort of a metaphor, I guess, about security. You might think that if you're... or the modernists would tell us, the harm reductionists might tell us that a flock of sheep free on a mountaintop with no fences around them, free to gamble all they would, B-O-L, about living their day, are free and truly free. But the realist will say, no, they aren't free. A, they're going to be, they will not be gambling about living on this mountaintop, because they will actually end up having to huddle together in the middle for fear of falling over the cliffs, for fear of being attacked by wolves. They need a fence to protect them. They will be truly free inside that structure. Truly free, prevented from falling over the cliffs, and also protected from the wolves and the other predators. They will enjoy their lives a lot more inside of that fence. Anyway, there's my little metaphor.
I think it's a good metaphor, because look, I don't know, you guys are in an office at the moment. I'm sitting in my home. I'm sitting in a structure, and even without this home, I have a structure, which is the discipline called David Berner. I mean, there's this persona, this character who's set up, some boundaries in his life, which addicts don't have. If you want to help addicts, you can't just give them dope or needles. You have to help them learn to create boundaries and create self-discipline. Anything less than that is anti-human.
And it's anti-recovery. And, David, I want to touch briefly on methadone, because anytime I have a conversation about harm reduction or drug recovery in Vancouver, I try to bring up methadone because it's something that kind of happens under the radar. Yes, Insight grabs all the headlines, Stephen Harper talks about it, but nobody ever talks about the methadone program. I wrote about it a couple of years ago extensively. You know it very well. Basically, the methadone program in British Columbia, which is concentrated in the downtown east side of Vancouver, requires or it does not have any mandatory treatment or counseling attached to it. All you need to do is go to a doctor, get a prescription, and then you're on methadone. I was talking to a fella in the downtown east side just last week. He had been hurt in the forestry industry, kind of graduated from morphine from his injuries onto heroin. It's kind of a familiar story. And now he's on methadone to kick the heroin. And the look in his eyes, I just felt so angry, because he was really upset about what the government had done. He was telling me, as I hear often, that methadone is far more addictive than heroin. It's tougher to kick, and yet these guys are thrown on it, and they're basically robbed of their destinies. They become zombies, and some of them can stay on it for decades. What's your sense of the methadone scourge in Vancouver?
Methadone, let's have a simple fact. This has been proven over and over and over again. Methadone is 6 times more addictive than heroin. Methadone is 6 times more addictive than heroin. It's
brutal.
A nightmare. It's almost impossible to get off. And to make matters worse, the people who provide methadone for addicts don't make much of an effort to get them off. Now, there are a handful of recovery programs who, as a practicality, take a handful of people who are on methadone. This is both men's and women's recovery programs. But they work very hard to get those people detoxified out of the methadone within a week or two as quickly as they can so they can move on. And the reason is simple. You cannot talk to a person who is high. You cannot talk to a drunk who's drunk. You cannot talk to a junkie who's on heroin. You can't talk to a crack lunatic who's on crack, and you can't talk to a methadone guy who's on methadone. And you are right, Mark. The methadone industry is enormous here. Someone should do a survey and find out how many pharmacies are dispensing methadone and how much they're dispensing them. Some of those pharmacies, I'm willing to bet there's a handful of them who basically make their living handing out this crap, and they might as well be heroin dealers,
Well, I know that both Marcus said this concentrated in the downtown east side. I live in the suburbs.
No, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. I go into my neighborhood drugstore. If I'm there in the morning to pick up a prescription or something like that, there'll be some people lined up there getting their little glasses of orange juice, and that's methadone.
Yeah.
And that's right in my neighborhood in the suburbs. That's right. So.
And this has been, look, this has been going on as long as I've been in this business. I mean, I went to a conference in Ottawa in 1969 or something, and people were blathering about handing stuff off and Tang and grape juice. And I said, what are you guys, astronauts? You know, I mean, it's preposterous. It's a preposterous, anti-human, hideous activity. Look, this ties into what I was going to say earlier. Here's one of the great ironies of this business, that the harm reduction folks always like to talk about, as soon as I hear this phrase, I leave the room. They say, well, I believe in a continuum of care.
Right?
That's their catchphrase, a continuum of care. Except that they are lying. They mean that they believe in a continuum of care in every respect except abstinence.
Right.
And I have been in the mayor's presence, not this puppet, but the previous mayor. I've been at a workshop that the previous mayor held where his drug czar and his right-hand 100 grand a year man were both saying openly, as if it were a fact, that treatment doesn't work. They were also saying that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work and that Narcotics Anonymous doesn't work. Let me tell you, I personally know thousands of clean and sober 12-step people. Thousands.
That's a shocking statement to hear.
We talked about
abstinence tonight, and when I hear that, I think immediately of the 12-step program that Alcoholics Anonymous made famous, but which has been adapted for everything from cocaine into heroin and all sorts of. Do most of these abstinence-based programs essentially have 12-step programs, or are there a variety?
Yeah,
and do they all work?
There's a full range. BHF in Manitoba doesn't. I don't know if Portage at Carameas does. Baldy Hughes has a 12-step element that's very strong. A lot of people in these programs, if the program itself doesn't have 12 steps, they will attend 12-step programs. The program that I started, Excalais, I mean, it uses the same principles, but we never had 12-step meetings. But I happen to personally believe, and this is from experience, that the 12-step programs modeled originally with AA, but now you have Overeaters Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, and so on. I believe that program is one of the great social gifts to the world of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and I don't know why it's never been recognized as such.
Well, could it be, and this is just a little pet theory I have, that one of the reasons that the official government people don't like this is because isn't there one of the steps that says you have to sort of give yourself up to the higher power, recognize that there is a higher power? It's not a specific religion thing, but I know a fellow, Billy Wesolowski, who runs the Inner Visions place, and he gets down on his knees every morning and just prays to a higher power. He doesn't know who it is, what it is, but basically has to start his day every day that way. And he's been very successful. I haven't seen him for many years. I hope he's still successful as he was.
He's very successful. His son, Max, was at our conference.
Oh, excellent. Okay. And so is this higher power thing, does that scare our big governments these days?
I don't think that's what scares the big government, but the higher power issue is something we should talk about, and I want to comment on. I think the reason that governments are not that enamored of 12-step programs is because there's no role for them. There's no way they can take credit for anything. There's no funding. You see, one of the beauties of 12-step programs, there's no money. There's no presidents. There's no recording secretaries. It's a bunch of people going into a church basement at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night and standing up and saying, "Hi, my name's Bob. I'm powerless over alcohol."
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's pretty simple. And they tell their story and sit down. You know, and nobody, you know, criticizes them, nobody judges them, and it works. Now, the issue of higher power, look, it's, you know, the step says, I came to believe in a higher power, and I turned myself over to a higher power. So a lot of people will say, well, you know, 12 steps don't work for me because I don't believe in God, and I don't like all that God talk. But that's a cop-out. You don't have to believe in God. It could be a rabbit's foot. It could be a lucky charm. It could be a pillow. It could be anything. You know, it could be TV guide. Whatever you want to.
Could be roadkill radio.
What? What'd you say?
I said it could be roadkill radio.
It could be roadkill radio as your higher power. The idea is that, look, life is mysterious, and none of us have any grand answers, and there's something going on that we can't quite assess and name, and for convenience, we call that God or a higher power. You want to call it Jesus, you want to call it Moses, you want to call it Muhammad, go ahead. Whatever works for you, you know. The point is to get out of your ego, get out of your vanity, get out of your whining and focusing on yourself. There are forces bigger than us. Listen, I had a minor miracle happened last week up at Baldy Hughes.
We can't get into that, David, because we're just running out of time now. Our show ends in 2 minutes.
Okay.
And we do really want to thank you very much. You've been a most entertaining, engaging, and informative guest, David Berner of the Drug Prevention Network of Canada.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, guys.
Good night. Talk to you again soon, and good luck with all you do. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
He is a great guest, and we could have probably gone on for a lot longer, eh, Mark?
He is something else, I tell you. You get that guy in a room, and he owns it.
Yeah, well, very dynamic, and you can see why he earned his living in broadcasting for so many years. Very dynamic. And and as an ex-Winnipeg person myself who came out here about 50 years ago myself, I one of the first things that I was told by my mother was, stay away from the drugs in Vancouver. It's very interesting. David, we had the reputation of the city back then, and you know, despite all the countless programs, the hundreds of millions of dollars, the scores of agencies, is it any better?
Well, from what I hear, and I cover it quite closely from people on the street, the police, the frontline workers, it gets worse every day.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's not good news. I'm going to be away for the next month or so. I'm emceeing an event next week, and then I'm on summer vacation, so I'm not going to be back until August. I'm not sure what your schedule is like.
Quite sure.
So we'll have to check in with the producer, Carrie Simpson, see how she's going to carry on with it. Carrie will carry on with the show, I'm sure. But we will let you all know out there through email, and so we hope to see you back here again next week with some surprises, because we don't know what Carrie has on tap, do we? So anyway, thanks very much for joining us, and thank you, Mark, for joining me tonight. It's great to see you again, and keep up the good work, and I hope we do more work together in the future.
I do, too. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you. And for Mark, I'm Terry O'Neill. Good night, and we'll see you again soon on Roadkill Radio.
You've been listening to Roadkill Radio. Join us again next week for another trip down the superhighway of information, fact, and truth.